Okay, so there's this girl that I went to high school with who just posted like a job that I might be interested in on LinkedIn. Do you think it's weird if I like DM her? I literally have not spoken to this girl since high school, which is 7 years ago now.
Wow, damn, we're old.
Don't get me started.
No, I'm kidding. No, I think it's not weird at all. I was actually talking about something similar with friends. I was just making fun of my parents on how they sometimes bump into like old friends from junior high or like, when we were like 5 years old. And they were just like, they just have this easy way of diving into the small talk, even though you haven't seen them in decades. So I feel like when we grow up, and we are grown-ups at the end of the day, we are adults.
That's
I think
scary.
we need to be that, be like, hey, hello. We knew each other and I want to ask you something. I think that's part of being grown-ups and making connections. At the end of the day, we are working and sometimes you might need a favor or like something from someone else. So
Fair.
I think that's fine.
Fair. Okay. I will reach out then. Everyone, fingers
Perfect.
crossed.
So, what are you doing this weekend?
I think my boyfriend and I might go on a movie date this weekend because we haven't been to a movie in like years. I don't know the last time I was in a movie theater, honestly. But we're either going to see Wicked or the new Lion King.
I love them.
I know. And
I mean, I haven't seen The Lion King though.
I know I'm late to the party on both, so no one judge me. But I haven't seen them yet, and I kind of want to see both of them. I have a few friends who would like slap me if I saw Lion King over Wicked. I don't know. Are you one of those friends, Matt?
The thing is, I personally, Wicked is my favorite Broadway musical, and Lion King is my favorite animated movie. So I'm really excited to see Mufasa too. Don't get me wrong, but the thing is, I feel like Wicked premiered in Thanksgiving, I think. So I think it might be leaving soon. So that's why I would suggest seeing like Wicked in
Fair.
movie theater, and then you can watch Mufasa. I mean, it's gonna still. I think it's just premiered, so it's fine.
Okay, I will let you know which movie I end up seeing this weekend, and we will loop back on that. But anyway, I want to welcome everyone back to the third episode of the Goal Getter Podcast. I'm so excited to be saying that. I think I'm going to say every single episode how excited I am to be back because I'm just really proud of us for making it to episode three. So welcome back to the Goal Getter Podcast, where we're truly about lifting each other up and empowering women from all walks of life to chase their career dreams, break barriers, and celebrate their successes. Big or small. So in this episode, we have our first interview, which is super exciting. We have one of our good friends, Elle Oda, on with us to talk about her time volunteering on the board of the Renegade Relief Runners in Ukraine. I think you guys are gonna love this interview. And yeah, so stay tuned.
I'm so excited for this interview. I think we couldn't have a better guest to kick off this interview section within Goal Getter. So I'm so excited, so happy. You guys are gonna love it. So without further ado, let's go to the interview.
Hi, everybody. We're so excited to welcome our first guest to the pod. Elle Oda is a board member with the Renegade Relief Runners, founded soon after Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine in 2022. Renegade Relief Runners is a registered 501c3 organization in the U.S. and has a ground team in Ukraine that focuses on delivering humanitarian aid to underserved communities in Ukraine, particularly villages near the front lines. It's great to have you here, Elle.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yay. Well, I guess we want to know more about you. Like, where did you grow up? Did you think you were going to be doing this as a kid?
Yeah, so I grew up mostly in San Diego, California. I spent my childhood going to the beach, doing junior lifeguard camp. I really wanted to be a marine biologist for many years, so I would not say that I really envisioned myself delivering aid in a country at war. I did want to be a paleontologist for many years, and I like had this dream that I would have a Jeep where I would put my dinosaur bones and use that to drive across various landscapes. So, in a way, that came true. We do drive trucks with large things, just, aid or tools in them. No dinosaur bones for me. So, yeah, I mean, in high school, I think I was a bit lost trying to figure out what exactly I wanted to do for my career. And I think, like a lot of ambitious, nerdy high school students, you get slated into the science category. So I had a lot of people pushing me toward a career in STEM. But I think when I got to university, I have really had the opportunity to delve into the topics that were interesting to me. I actually majored in archaeology, classics, and anthropology. And I always have to explain to people the connection, but I specialized in the politics, using anthropology to study politics of international heritage management. And that was kind of my segue into looking at how, large multilateral bodies are managing people. That kind of led me to the world of human rights and humanitarian aid, which is what I do now.
Super interesting. That's like such an indirect path, but such an amazing place to end up. So, how would you describe your role within Renegade Relief Runners now?
Yeah, so I basically have two roles, although, like many people in the organization, we wear a lot of hats and do a lot of overlapping tasks. So, officially, I work as the Chief Strategy Officer and a board member of Renegade Relief Runners. As Chief Strategy Officer, essentially, I help to define the external facing side of the organization. So, doing everything from writing communications to our supporters on social media, on email, helping to do fundraising and grants, and defining our advocacy efforts. So, essentially, when I explain externally facing roles, I usually frame it as, how do we define our mission statement and how do we communicate its value to the world? Which is super important with Ukraine because, many of our supporters are international. They're not based in Ukraine or Eastern Europe. So we're constantly having to convince people, even now as this war reaches 3 years, why this is something they should care about, why this is something, my family in California, where I am now, should be supporting. As a board member, now I play a much broader role, I think, in terms of ensuring the organization is well managed. So those of us on the board play a role in doing long-term planning to ensure that our donations are making the greatest impact when it comes to aid on the ground. We do a lot of capacity building for the team. This is a very small organization, which I can get into in a little bit, but our ground team ranges sometimes from just 5 people to maybe 10. So we do a lot of work in terms of making sure that everybody is set up for success and that they're situated in roles where they can grow, but also be most effective. And then finally, and we'll talk about this more, but I get to be an aid volunteer, which is the fun part. So I'm helping out constantly when I'm there with ground projects, driving trucks, delivering aid. So there's a lot of work that happens at the same time. And I also have a full-time online job, which is at the Human Rights Foundation. So that's always going to be the priority when I'm working because that is my main career and that's the job that pays me. But all of my work with Renegade Relief Runners, I'm extremely passionate about and is in a volunteer capacity.
That's so inspiring. By the way, hold on. So you went from wanting to have dinosaur bones in your Jeep to this volunteering sidekick job. So how did you hear from them? Why did you get involved in the first place?
Yeah, so similar to the first question you asked, this one also has quite a bit of turns and somersaults. When I first saw Russia launch its full-scale invasion of Ukraine in February of 2022, obviously it was something I was interested in. Given my work in human rights, I was paying very close attention to the conflict. Thinking about what I could do to help from afar. I definitely wanted to get involved, but didn't really see an avenue in. And I, as an American who had never been to Ukraine, I didn't know how to really be helpful and support this cause in a meaningful way. So by chance in 2022, I was living at the time with my boyfriend in Poland, and his family was extremely passionate about Ukraine and had organized a convoy of trucks to drive from Warsaw to Kyiv with humanitarian aid. This was back in October of 2022, and I was there and they needed extra drivers and they said, "Would you like to drive a truck in this convoy?" And I was like, "Sure. I drive a lot, being from California. I'm happy to give it a shot. I have never driven 15 hours straight," which the journey from Warsaw to Kyiv is quite long. And by this point, I've made it many times. Was super nervous going to Ukraine for the first time, even though we were only there for a couple of days. I think looking in at the situation in Ukraine, when you listen to the news, you tend to hear the worst of the worst. Cities getting bombed, elementary schools, hospitals. And so I did a lot of, mental preparation and physical preparation beforehand to make sure that I had all the supplies ready to keep myself safe. We drove in. It went incredibly smoothly. And actually, even though we were only there for a couple of days, we met some incredibly inspiring groups on the ground. And so the humanitarian landscape in Ukraine is so interesting because you have all of these different groups from many different countries really running aid to the places where it's needed most. And even though there are a lot of big organizations as well, like the UN and the Red Cross, these smaller organizations are really the ones getting the aid to these difficult to reach communities. And so one of the groups that I had met was Renegade Relief Runners. They were just a really small organization, pretty fragmented. They had just gained 501c3 status, but didn't have a home base, didn't have an office, didn't have anyone in defined roles. They were oftentimes just sleeping in their cars, running out aid, and then running back, putting more gas in the cars, and going from there. So I was really inspired by all the work they were doing. I went on a few little aid runs in Kyiv with them. And afterward, I just offered. I said, "Hey, do you guys need volunteers to do stuff from abroad or in person? I work at a nonprofit, so I have some skills in terms of communications. Like, I know of some grants that maybe we could look into." And they said, "Yes, absolutely. We can use any help that we can get," which is very much their attitude when it comes to volunteers. And they really let me take that role and run with it. And so I'm so grateful for them entrusting me with a leadership capacity. I've now been with them for over 2 years and have gone from just, helping now and then on my laptop to really being a board member and a fully integrated part of the team.
I actually remember 2 years ago or over 2 years ago, how long it's been now, your first time you were going to Ukraine and us like talking about all the dangers and what it was going to be like. And none of us really knew. And I guess I don't even know now, but can you tell the audience what a normal or a typical day volunteering on the front lines of Ukraine is like?
Well, it's kind of an impossible question to answer. I mean, every day in Ukraine looks so different depending on what's happening and what we're working on. When I'm in Ukraine, I usually work with Renegade Relief Runners in the morning, and those tasks range from having meetings with the team, doing long-term planning, shopping for supplies, organizing the warehouse, any number of those things. And then I work New York hours for my online job at the Human Rights Foundation. So starting at 3 or 4 p.m., pretty much until 11 or midnight, I am online doing all my meetings. So it's definitely a balance, and I've had to learn that over time is really how to, juggle these different priorities. But I do try to make the most of my time when I'm there. During aid runs, which is a bit different, but maybe more fun to talk about. The aid runs we have more of a schedule for, because now that we've done this so many times, we, have a regimen that we follow to make sure that we are sending aid where it's helpful, but also that we're keeping ourselves safe. So usually the day before, you'll find us preparing, loading the aid into the trucks that we drive out to the east. We are checking our IFACs, which stands for Individual First Aid Kit, as well as our body armor that we wear when we go to some of the more risky zones. And Then we usually try to get out to the east or the south. You know, we focus on those regions because that's where most of the fighting is. And so we'll try to drive out usually before evening to avoid curfew. Many places in Ukraine still have an early curfew. So in Kharkiv, I think it's 11 right now. Kyiv, it's a bit later. It's 12 midnight. So yeah, we'll get there in the evening usually. And then for the aid runs themselves, we leave quite early in the morning. And we work usually with local partners to identify the communities that are most in need. So we're constantly in touch with local village administrations who are able to give us intel about the safety situation on the day of, you know, how much aid is needed, and also devise a system to make sure that aid is allocated fairly for the families in the area. So yeah, usually we drive out. It'll take a couple hours sometimes. We make sure that we bring all of our safety equipment. As I said before, when I am out east, you will always find an IFAK strapped to me, even if I'm just going out for coffee or a dinner. You never know what can happen, and it's better to be safe rather than sorry. We're also very, you know, we try to be as safe as possible when we go out. So we drive slowly, we drive in a convoy, we make sure that we avoid taking unnecessary risks, driving too fast, going into unknown territory where there might be landmines. And, you know, in the cases where it is more risky, really our goal is to get in and get out as soon as possible. The longer you stay in a place, the more of a target you make yourself, especially if you're dropping off a lot of aid and there's a whole bunch of people congregated in the same area, that easily becomes a target. And we know from experience that the Russian army doesn't hesitate to target humanitarian aid workers, even though, you know, that is a war crime. But it's a way to dissuade people from doing this type of work and also demoralize the local Ukrainian population. So we do this as best as we can. By now, certain of our group members have been doing this for a very long time. Everybody is trained in tactical care and combat medicine. So yeah, we make the most of our time and we try to just do it safely and make sure people get what they need.
Wow, that this is very interesting. And earlier you mentioned something very important, which is how you prepare physically and mentally, and I'm assuming emotionally too. So how do you stay motivated and maintain balance while navigating such a meaningful role? You mentioned having your main job, HRF, and then doing this for the rest of the day. How do you keep that healthy balance in your life?
Absolutely. Balance is key. I think working two jobs essentially at the same time requires a lot of personal structure and discipline. You will see I have lists upon lists of all the things I need to do. You know, I make sure that the time that I set aside to work on HRF for 8 hours a day, that I really give myself a good working space to do that. And the time I need to like take my meetings, have a good internet connection, have a quiet desk area to do this. And I think, you know, in terms of balance when it comes to Ukraine, it's pretty easy right now, especially to get overwhelmed by the situation in general. There is a lot of war fatigue, there's uncertainty about the future, there's consistent losses across the front lines, as well as fear. You know, when you go to these places, it is stressful. I do still get scared. But I think in all these situations, I tend to focus on the factors that I can control. You know, can I get out an email today? Is that a little win? Can I finish this grant report? You know, I can't stop you know, a missile barrage from hitting Kyiv. Can I make sure that I am in an air raid shelter or, you know, in a bunker if needed, if the situation gets bad? Do I have what I need to keep me safe at all times? So I think, you know, that's sort of how I go about thinking about war. I think a good example that I can remember from recently. So during this past election in November, obviously a pretty difficult week for a lot of Americans. And I remember I was just feeling so hopeless at the time. I was actually stuck in Poland because one of our vans broke down and I was just sitting by myself in a hotel room alone. And I was like, God, I just feel so useless. So much of this is beyond my control. And, you know, I can't fix this. Like, this is going to be a huge issue that our country and the world faces over the next couple of years. And nothing that I do individually now is going to make a difference. So to motivate myself, I was like, I need to do something with my hands. And so I reached out to all my family and friends on social media, and I asked them to give me $10 to start building meal kits for villages in Ukraine. A meal kit only really costs $10, and it has all of the essential items that a family would need to get through, you know, 2 weeks if they don't have access to grocery stores. So I was overwhelmed by the number of people who actually gave me money, and I got enough to make 300 meal kits. So the week after the election, I was literally running around stuffing, you know, grain and pasta into boxes. But, you know, it's just an example. It gave me something to do where I was like, this is something I can control. This is something good that I can do at a time when everything feels like it's spiraling out of control. So, you know, that's kind of a small example of a much broader attitude that I have when it comes to aid work, especially in war zones.
That's an amazing example and kind of rolls into the next question I wanted to ask you about your most rewarding moments, because I bet for doing this for 2.5 years and continuing to do this, there must be moments that are super hard mentally to get through, but also the rewarding moments that make all of this worth it.
Absolutely. Well, there's so many. It's honestly hard to choose. I think a lot of the rewarding moments just come from doing the aid runs themselves. You know, I my Ukrainian is not up to par. So obviously there's a language barrier for me when we go on many of these runs, but I've been pleasantly surprised by how much you can understand on a very basic human level, even when you go to these places. I don't know. I have a lot of memories, you know, I think always young people and kids are especially touching. The communities we serve are often elderly people and then women and children who are kind of stuck in these villages close to the front lines. So we always buy extra candy bars. Usually we'll have to stop at a gas station and we'll bring extra candy bars for the kids. And, you know, I remember one time we were dropping stuff off. And some of these kids have never seen Americans. They're like, what are these people doing here? They look very different. We don't understand them. You know, they're carrying a lot of big, heavy things and they'll be hiding behind their parents. And I remember just extending candy bars to people and their faces just light up because they're like, oh, this is a language, you know, we don't understand English. I don't understand Ukrainian, but like we understand basic human compassion and nobody's going to say no to sugar, especially when you're not having that sort of candy readily available in these villages. So that always makes me smile. And, you know, sometimes we have really lovely interactions with the local village administrations because they're the ones organizing this, you know, telling us what time to arrive, telling all of the elderly people, hey, you know, bring your carts, come to the city hall at 12 and humanitarian aid will be ready. And occasionally, babushkas or Ukrainian grandmothers will prepare us thank you meals. So I've had some of the best borscht of my life prepared by village recipients when we go as just a small way of thanking us for bringing aid to their communities. That's always really rewarding. And then finally, I've many fond memories, you know, after our aid runs, we have our traditions of going to our favorite places in Kharkiv City and just celebrating with some drinks and some good food with all of our local partners who really make my day.
I have a confession to make. I almost cried during that story. So that's that was so emotional. No, and I think it's beautiful to hear sometimes the people who are enduring these challenging moments or that they don't have enough are the one that give the most sometimes. Sometimes people in more privileged positions, they're not giving enough. And that's so beautiful to hear that they are preparing meals or doing whatever they can to thank you and your team. It's truly inspiring.
It feels like it's so weird sometimes because we're dropping off meal kits for people and then they're giving us soup in return. And I'm like, no, like, please save that. You don't need to feed us. But you know, it's Ukrainian hospitality. It's any Ukrainian household that you step into, especially if there is a woman there, she will make sure that you are very well fed. And in fact, I was told the last time this happened, in Ukrainian, like, this one needs to eat more. They were like, just doling more soup onto my plate. And they also had, God, they had chicken liver, I think, which I am not a huge fan of, but I got a lot ladled onto my plate. And I was really like, no, I'm please no more.
Well, I mean, I love these stories. I think this is exactly why you do what you do, right? And it's just all about the human experience. So, and I think also your specific situation of managing like two jobs is also part of the human experience. Everyone, most women are witnessing and experiencing too. So what advice would you give to women who are looking to make a difference in the humanitarian aid space, but might not know where to start or what to do?
I love this question because it's definitely one that I asked myself as I was getting involved. I would say to reflect on your unique skill set and think about what it is you can bring to the table. The really nice thing about the aid world is that it's incredibly interdisciplinary. So whether you have a background in marketing or creating budgets, if you are a policy expert, if you know how to do logistics or translating or organizing hospital supplies, even if you were, you know, in the military or something, your talents can be extremely useful no matter which aid group that you're working with. So I would say, you know, think about how you're going to insert yourself. And then really just say yes to opportunities and initiatives whenever you can. You know, this is very close to my heart because this was my entryway into this type of work. Is it started off truly with me just texting the founders of Renegade Relief Runners and saying, hey, can I help? I can do XYZ. Do you want me to do this? If not, cool. But like, if you want me to, I'm there. I'm here for you. And I just got this, you know, resounding, yes, absolutely, we will take your help. And I was like, okay, this is great. I have something. I can start small and just scale it up from there. So I feel like saying yes to opportunities is kind of my mantra because it's afforded me so much out of life. Like I've been to some really amazing places and met so many people just because I took a chance and was like, yeah, I'll try. It's okay to try and fail. It's something. So yeah, I think that's my advice to anybody looking to start out in the aid world, but also just in general, whatever you're passionate about.
That's a great quote. It's okay to try and fail. L. Yeah.
Quote by L. I love yeah.
that. I'll take all the credit for that quote. I made it up.
I think Renegade Relief Runners is a women-led organization. If I don't stand corrected, there's a lot of women on the board. Is that correct?
Yeah. One of our, I would say, I mean, it's a mix. Our founders are, one is female, one is male, but we have a lot of women in leadership. And at this point, I would say the majority of people working on the leadership positions are women. We obviously have a lot of male volunteers. The aid world, and I can get into this a bit later, but the aid world itself is pretty male dominated. So we're actually quite lucky to have so many amazing, competent women working in our organization.
Yeah, definitely. Can you describe or give our audience a little bit of a view into that and like explain some other women that you've met doing this? It's not just, you're not the only woman in this organization. What are the other women doing? What are their little bit of backgrounds? Can you just give us a little bit of insight into these other amazing women that you work with on the ground?
Yeah. So, oh gosh, where to start right now? Well, one of our founders, her name's Julia Abratańska from Poland. She has done such an amazing job in creating this organization. And it was really, you know, through her faith that this was going to be something useful and that this was something needed that we exist at all. So she is really a core pillar of Renegade Relief Runners. We have Valeria Stepanenko, who is a Ukrainian woman who just turned 22 years old. And she is the most mature 22-year-old I've ever met. She does an insane amount of coordinating aid on the ground. Because she is Ukrainian, she speaks the language. She's the one who sets up many of our partnerships with the local administrations that I was mentioning before. and does everything from organizing the expenses of our aid to ordering bulk meal kits from the Ukrainian version of Costco, which is called Metro. We have Olga, who's also from Poland, who manages all of our finances. It's a huge job because we have so much aid passing in and out of our organization. Keeping track of it all is a major feat, so she is handling that. We have Melissa, who's a U.S.-based volunteer, who's a doctor herself, actually, and who organizes all of the medical supplies that we deliver. And that's because the supplies that are most needed are really specific sometimes, and you actually need to have a doctor's license to order some of them. So she has been an absolute champ in terms of sourcing some of those really unique and difficult to find medical supplies, both for military units in Ukraine as well as for civilian populations. And then I would be remiss to not mention all of the amazing women who are part of the local administrations, who are leading other aid organizations, who, you know, you don't often picture women driving semi trucks full of aid to war zones, but there are so many amazing women on the ground who are inspiring to me, who I've met along the way.
I love a good supporting group of women working together toward the same goal. And even I can only imagine the amount of lessons and experiences that you've been through together. So what kind of lessons about resilience or leadership you've learned from these incredible women that you've been working with?
Yeah, I think so. One thing to know about Ukrainian women is that they are brutally direct, honest, and they don't take shit. Sorry, I don't know if I can say that on your podcast.
Yeah, say anything you want.
Yeah, and it's honestly been refreshing because I think culturally, Ukrainians can be quite different than Americans. Oftentimes, Americans think that Ukrainians have this initial coldness, like they won't smile a lot of the times when you first meet them, just culturally, like, you know, you meet somebody with a straight face and it takes a little bit of time to warm up to people. But I will say once you do, there's this unwavering sense of loyalty, like the friends that I've made in Ukraine, I know I will keep for the rest of my life. But I think the honesty and the direct part is really important and a good like leadership takeaway for me, because I think sometimes, especially when you're working in a high stress job, when a lot of stuff is happening, open and clear communication is really key. And that's something that I think we as women often skirt around sometimes. You know, we don't want to say something that offends someone. We don't want to sometimes be too bold or be too aggressive or come off as bitchy or rude or badgering. And it's just, it's funny because it's not really a thing in Ukraine. Ukrainian women will just be like, why is this not done? It should have been done now. When are you going to finish it? I mean, I've had people say that to me directly, but it can be jarring sometimes, especially as a Californian who is all, you know, like sunshine, beaches, rainbows. But at the same time, it's really important, I think, that we communicate directly and just sometimes say it in a straight way. So I think that's been an interesting cultural experience from my standpoint. As I said before, the Ukraine aid world can be really dominated by men. So most of the volunteers that we're working with who are driving the trucks, carrying the aid, a lot of them are men, you know, who are happy to go to risky zones and lift heavy boxes. A lot of the soldiers that we work with are men. And even the policy experts and academics and journalists who work on Ukraine are men. So it's really interesting sometimes. It can be difficult as a woman to assert yourself in certain situations and make sure that your voice is heard. And I would just say I've learned from experience, from watching others that I really respect and care about, to just know your worth and don't hold back. I've been told, you know, by journalists that I really respect to become an expert on a particular topic, know what your area of skills and expertise is. And when it comes time to say something, just don't hold back. Say what you need to say. And if, you know, you value your own voice, then others will begin to as well. And that's always going to be an uphill battle. But I do believe that. And I've tried to do that more and more in my own line of work.
I love that. That's great advice. And I think something that we want this podcast to fight against is stereotypes, of course, stereotypes of women in leadership roles and what they actually look like. So can you give us some stereotypes that you think need to be smashed immediately about women in leadership and why?
I love this question, and I'll talk about it from the aid standpoint, because that's what I'm here to discuss. So one of the tropes that I think is the funniest and very relevant here is the, I'll call this the quote unquote, what do we do now trope. So in any action movie or something, there will always be this beautiful woman with far too much makeup. And when crisis strikes, you know, she'll turn to the man and scream like, what do we do now? And like, you know, I'm sure you've heard it, but like, if you start looking for it in movies and TV shows, you will see it everywhere and it will drive you crazy. And I say this is a stereotype that I would want to smash, because I know that when in real life, when a crisis does emerge, you will never hear a woman asking this question, what do we do now? Like, women are always the ones who think through all of the different scenarios and have, you know, not only plans A and B, but also like C, D, E, F, yeah, so on and so forth. And, you know, this idea that women get paralyzed in a crisis just couldn't be further from the truth. I mean, even in aid situations in Ukraine where stuff gets a little dicey, you know, the women on our team are so well prepared. They are ready to give directions, jump into action, make sure that they and their team members are safe. And I think that's, you know, that's such a key thing, such a misunderstanding of how women react in crisis situations. And you can even, you know, you can even think about that way outside of a war zone. But think about it, you know, in your own places of work, like when something happens, when an emergency strikes, as it always does, even in an office setting, who are the ones who are most reactive? It's always the women. Yeah. Not saying that men can't, obviously, but I think this idea that women are going to be underprepared and frozen is just so blatantly false.
Yeah, no. I agree too. I hate that I'm going to be like very aware when I'm watching a movie. I'm like, oh my God.
Yes,
and
I just, so crazy.
Yeah. And I just heard Reese Witherspoon saying the exact same thing, like what you just said. So it's very interesting that it's getting out there. So I'm just hoping writers out there get more creative when writing a woman in movies or a TV show. But I want to ask you something. I personally love this question. I love answering this one myself, but the answer always changes. So if you could tell your younger self one thing about becoming a woman who lives with impact, what would it be?
This is a hard question, but I'll go back to something that we talked about before. I would tell my younger self to embrace failure, because it allows you to grow. I think I've always been, but particularly when I was younger, somebody who strives for perfection and can be really concerned with maintaining that perfection and maintaining what other people think of me. And I know that perfection is the enemy of progress. I definitely didn't come up with that. I've heard one of my colleagues say that over and over again, but it's true. It's like, when I think back on my life, even just over this past year, the experiences that have forced me to grow most have been experiences of failure. So I think the experiences that have really made me grow most have been when stuff doesn't go according to plan and when you lose. But it's a learning experience to take those losses, sit with them. And of course, you can be sad and upset in the beginning, but then think to yourself, okay, how are we going to fix this? What steps do I need to take to rectify the situation? And if you can embrace those steps and start thinking through and problem solving, that's really when you grow the most, at least for me. Like, those are the moments when my, you know, character has been the most tested. And if you're able to come out on the other side, then I think those are the really invaluable experiences. So I would just want to tell my younger self to not be afraid of embracing those. They happen. It's life. And just learn from them and take more risks, even if it means failing.
I think that resonates a lot with my life as well. I think every time, you know, I'm stuck with a hurdle, I always, at least I try, or I think I do, come out the other side stronger. And I think that should be, or is everyone's goal at the end of the day. But all the growth and leadership stuff aside, we put our work aside, put everything aside, or close our computer. Why do you think self-care outside of the workplace is so important for women? Because we've talked about all this stuff, right? Going to war zones, helping other people, and the amazing love that they give back, which also I think can be included in or under the category of self-care, because I think that can really help you understand why you're doing something like this. But at the end of the day, after everything is said and done, why do you think personal self-care is important?
I think women have the tendency to adopt roles of being caretakers or providers in whatever setting they're working in, whether, you know, whether you're helping out relatives that are sick, whether you're working in a team in an office, whether you're packaging aid. I think women often take up these roles of like being a provider, caring for other people, and there's this constant effort to make sure that the people around you are comfortable, are taken care of, that your friends and family are all doing well. Like, women are very social, and so there's, I think, extra effort that we put into making sure all of the relationships that we have are being cared for and tended to. But I think that can, as you say, lead to burnout and fatigue when you're doing so many things at once. I think especially in the aid community, burnout is super real. So I do think it's really important that everybody takes time for themselves. And whatever that looks like, yeah, it can be closing the door and just, you know, being on your phone for a while. It can be going out into nature. Everybody has their way of unwinding. And I don't think people should feel guilty about taking that time, because you can never really go back and help people in a meaningful way if you're struggling intensely within your own person. And I've used the oxygen metaphor that I'm sure everybody's heard ad nauseum by now, but I've told many of my team members in Ukraine, you know, you can't help other people. You know, you need to put on your own oxygen mask if the plane is
crashing,
like, or losing pressure.
Yeah,
the oxygen masks drop.
I hope not crashing. Yeah.
No, if the plane crashes, you...
I mean, that's it.
Help, yeah.
But if you do have a chance to get some oxygen, put it on yourself first and then put it on the other people, because there's no way that you can actually be trying to do some good for the world if you yourself are really struggling.
Well, the plane thing, it's a great analogy. I never thought about that, but that is true. You need to take care of yourself first in order to like be there for others. Absolutely. But how do you recharge? You're mentioning the importance of keeping this balance and doing stuff outside the work or humanitarian aid, but how does Elle recharge?
Well, as you both know, as my friends, I am a very social person. So I think I relax and feel validated, feel excited when I'm around people. Not all the time, not 100% of the time. I definitely need like my nights alone just watching Netflix. But I would say in general, I get a lot of motivation and recharge by being around people. By like, you know, going out to drinks with my friends, when I'm in Ukraine with the team, if I want to bring everybody together, food is a huge motivator. So I will often order food delivery or maybe cook something for the group so that everybody can be together, be chatting. That's hugely rewarding. I love traveling. It gives me so much joy. I will never get tired of it. And I'm a very nerdy traveler too. So like when I go to a new place, I will read history books about it. I will make sure that I go to all of the cultural sites. And of course, because I studied archaeology, as I mentioned in the beginning, I will definitely nerd out about all the ruins. So like I find stuff that brings me joy and I capitalize on that. When I'm home in San Diego, as I am now, I do a lot of surfing, working out, yoga. I like to stay really active. I feel like that's a big thing for me when I'm stressed out. Being able to burn off energy is huge. That can be hard when you're in Ukraine and it's snowing outside, but I'm like, oh, there's something you can do inside. You can do yoga, you can do Pilates from YouTube, just something to keep your body active so that your mind is at peace.
Yeah, I love that.
Definitely. For the audience who doesn't know Elle, Elle is a big surfer. And she took me surfing one time about 2 years ago, and I thought I was going to drown. I'm pretty sure that board just would not stay under my feet. I've never surfed before. I grew up on the East Coast, as you guys know. And that board, one of the hardest things I've, athletic-wise I've ever done in my life. But if anyone wants surfing tips, you can talk to Elle.
I would love to learn.
It was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun sitting out there, riding the waves, all this. And I got like one good wave and I rode it on my stomach, but that was as far, there was no standing up for me. It was not in the cards that day.
Well, the most difficult part of, so everybody who tries surfing thinks that the hardest part is going to be standing up on the board, which is absolutely false. The hardest part is paddling through the waves when you're trying to go out and just getting hit in the face over and over again. And the thing is, I get hit in the face too. It's just I'm used to it from doing it so many years. But when you're doing it for the first time, it can be really shocking. And Grace is actually a really good swimmer. Like, you did swim team for years.
I swam all the way through almost all the way through college competitively. So I went into this thinking I was going to be amazing, and it was completely different. But it's okay. I'll go again.
That means that you have the surfer muscles to be effective. Okay. So you just, once you get used to, like, you know, basically somebody throwing a bucket of cold water in your face every minute.
Yeah.
So is it always cold?
Depends on where you are. San Diego, the water, it tends to be pretty frigid, especially in the winters, which I think is when Grace came. Summers, it's quite warm. You can probably get by without a wetsuit, but definitely in the winter. I mean, I went earlier this week and it was like frigid. Like, so usually I'm okay in the cold because I have like a pretty nice wetsuit now that keeps all my heat in, but it was so cold that when I got hit in the face with a wave, as I just said, it happens to everyone. I was like, wow. Like, it was like, it almost gave me a headache because it was so cold. So yeah, come to San Diego. It's warm and lovely. It's sunny outside right now in December, but the water is cold.
Okay, sure. Good to know. I live also like by the beach, but it's the complete opposite. We don't have any waves. It looks like a lake, and it's warm. Like, the water is warm. So,
but your beaches are absolutely stunning. I've been down to the Yucatan before, and that water, the water is like a bathtub, but it's like a turquoise unlike anything you'll see anywhere.
Yeah, 100%.
I had to add that little surfing tidbit in there. So anyone out there who wants to learn surfing, we can talk about that more. We can invite Elle back on the podcast to do a whole surfing
segment. We can get women in surfing on the podcast.
We should. Okay, we got to add that to our list.
It's also a very male-dominated sport. Usually I'm the only woman out there, and it's all these like really intense guys. But the fun thing, sorry, this is a tangent. So there's like a whole surfing etiquette, and people can be super aggressive sometimes. Like, if somebody takes off on a wave, you're not allowed to cut in on them. That's a huge faux pas. Mm. And like, people will sometimes get into fights and scream at each other in the water. And I will say, you know, I'm all for gender equality, but
that is such a man thing to do.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, when I'm going to San Diego, I'm 100% wearing something that says I'm learning, I'm new. Please.
Strapped on the side.
Yeah.
No, we'll take you to the Learner's Beach. And honestly, anybody who screams at somebody in the water, I'm like, chill the fuck out. Like, you're at a children's beach. Like, if you wanted to go surf some good waves, go somewhere else. Like,
it's supposed to be a chill sport, actually. Aren't like surfers like, yeah.
Yeah, it's just, there's too many, unfortunately, there's too many bodies in the water and too few waves. So people are protective sometimes.
Fair. You know. All right. Well, we have two fun last questions for you to kind of wrap up this amazing interview. So the first one is, if you could have a lunch with a badass woman from history, any time in history or pop culture, who would it be and what would you ask her?
Gosh, I hate this question.
Just say it.
I think I hate this question because I used to get asked it a lot when I was younger, and I would always kind of go through what I knew from history and think about like all these women that I read about in my textbook. And I was like, I don't know if I really want to have lunch with any of them. I will say now, In the work that I do with human rights, I have met some amazing female activists that honestly are a much better answer than anything I would have given as a child. Like, I have now had an amazing opportunity to like have lunch with people who have led their own protest movements and gotten out of prison in certain authoritarian regimes and gone to, the Hill to advocate, gone to meet the president. And so I will say already, those lunches that I've had with those ladies, they are incredibly impressive. There are so many female activists out there doing amazing work. Any of those will be better than the answers that I would have given as a kid. Honestly, now it's going to be Taylor Swift. It's always going to be. I went to the Eras Tour this year, changed my life, was going to be the Woodstock of our generation. And yeah, I mean, my answer is just because I love her and I just want to have lunch with her and talk about all of the songs that have changed my life. But I mean, if we want to talk about business, like she is the only self-made billionaire from music alone. Like not even just the only woman who's done that, but like the only artist who's a billionaire just from music. So I think that's incredibly impressive. She was the Time Person of the Year in 2023. Wow, that felt like a lifetime ago. This year, they just announced the Time Person of the Year, and it's
I
Donald Trump.
know.
And I'm
Yeah.
like,
I
how
know.
did we go from Taylor
Taylor
Swift,
Swift
the
to
best,
Donald Trump.
to the worst? I don't get it.
Yeah. That was a very controversial decision, actually. And I don't know if I agreed with it. They were like, well, he was like, and I get the whole like person of the year is supposed to be the person who like influenced the world the most, but I feel like there were so many other options. It didn't have to be him, and there was maybe just like a push to, I don't know, political or something back there to make him person of the year. Not to get all skeptical and
I
conspiracy
agree though. Like,
theorist, but
it's not like he did anything new this year. We knew exactly what he was standing for. And, one of the reasons that I guess so many people wanted him is that, like, they understood exactly what his presidency was going to look like. They saw it before. He hasn't changed any of his opinions. He's just gotten older and more decrepit. So why does that get person of the year? Like, at least go for Kamala or something, like who made a name for herself essentially by running for president.
I totally agree. It should have been someone who made history. Like Kamala did make history running for, she was the first woman to be chosen to run for a major political party. So
It
just
could have
saying,
been
Time Magazine.
the Goal Getter Podcast Girls.
Exactly. Exactly. You
That's
never know.
what
It's
I've been saying.
2025.
I know.
So, but hey, if anyone from Times is listening,
We're here.
exactly.
Speaking of musicians, if your life had a theme song, what would it be?
It can be a Taylor Swift song. No one will judge.
Well, it's gonna be a Taylor Swift song, but which one do we choose? Maybe I'll choose a Beyonce song. What good song? So the other thing was I didn't get Spotify Wrapped. Like I never got the little video explaining. Like there was no banner that popped up. So I was super
Weird.
disappointed.
Okay, Spotify, if you're listening, Elle needs her wrapped.
Yeah, send it to me. Show it to me, Rachel.
I love that video.
It just gets increasingly unhinged in the podcast now that we talk about questions. Gosh, okay. Well, I've been listening to the Tortured Poets Department nonstop, but I'm also like trying to be like, can I have a happy, like if I really wanted my life to have a theme song, I would want something happy that like gives me hope. It's difficult also because like the content of the song is different than the ones that I relate to. Like I could do Wouldn't It Be Nice by the Beach Boys, which I always listen to when I'm sad or being skeptical of life. I love that one so much. Yeah, there's also a lot of Taylor Swift songs about like renewals, having hope, like doing better in the future. Like clean is really nice in that sense. Begin again, always. I don't know. I want to be future oriented in my songs. I don't know. That's probably too many. I also, this was my year of pop. So like any trashy basic girl pop was like this. I mean, I don't know my Spotify Wrapped, but I am telling you it right now. Like Taylor, Sabrina Carpenter, Ariana Grande. Oof, that one was a really good album. Billie Eilish. There were so many. So like, give me all the pop girl songs and like, let me just do a playlist of my life that is going to be all female. Speaking of women, it's going to be all female.
Let's go.
Totally
Yay.
fair. I love that.
Yeah, Birds of a Feather was my top one song this year.
Yeah.
Such a good song.
My top one was first one with Post and Taylor. It's called, oh my gosh, I'm losing it.
I won't say mine because I think it was Five Men and that's embarrassing.
Is it One Direction?
No. She said Sat Rap, so.
No, that was last year.
But think of, like, is it
Bastard Boys and Sync?
How do I find my raps now? They're gone. It's not.
What was it?
You know, I'm not good with names, guys.
Oh, you're right.
I can't do this. It was. Five Seconds of Summer. Throwback.
I'm trying to think of like boy bands.
It was Benson Boone. Benson Boone. That was my top.
Yeah. We talked about this. Yeah.
Yes. With like Beautiful Things. And I apparently listened to Beautiful Things like thousands of times and I didn't even realize, but yes, Old Man is holding my rap this year. I'm sorry, guys. Next year I'll do better.
He's good looking.
I love that for you.
There you go, Nat.
That's coming from me.
Shout out to Benson Boone. Yeah, Nat's girlfriend's got to watch out.
So that's coming from me. He has this hot vibe. But I would say,
okay.
But I wouldn't say I'm in love with him. I think Harry Styles has that spot in my heart and my girlfriend's heart too. So we're just fighting for him. Both of us.
He's cute. I don't like his little stash.
Benson Boone. I actually don't know what he looks like. Benson Boone.
He has a wonderful voice too.
He does a wonderful voice, yeah. Oh, I agree, Elle. The stash has got to go. If Benson, if you're out there, no stash, but I'm loving the curly hair. Okay, that seems like a great way to end this interview. Thank you so much, Elle, for joining the Goal Getter podcast. I hope you had a good time, and we hope to have you on again in the future because this was a lot of fun.
Oh my gosh, yes, this was so much fun. It was like we started off on so much business talking about war zones, and then we ended on Benson Boone and Taylor Swift, which is very typical, honestly, for us. Yeah, no, it was truly a pleasure, and I think you guys are doing such cool work in terms of, you know, getting out stories, and like you both are so approachable, have had such interesting experiences. So I'm so glad you're sharing your stories with a broader audience, and yeah, honored to be your first guest. I hope you have many more, and I'm excited to listen to all the interesting, cool women you talk to.
Thank you. Well, thank you for joining us and sharing your work and your stories. It's just a reminder of the strength and resilience of women leading with impact under the most challenging circumstances. So thank you so much. And to our listeners, make sure to follow our Instagram account at GoalGetHer. And make sure to tune in next week. We have weekly episodes you don't want to miss. So see you next week.
Bye, guys.